Shannon Falk was a sweet 11-year-old girl who was friends with all of her neighbors. She was constantly bouncing from one house to another, either looking for playmates, to help her neighbors with chores, or just to find a good conversation. Then one summer day, she went missing and was never seen alive again. What happened to this vivacious little girl?
Killing. Missing. Hidden. A podcast about bad things.
Welcome, welcome, welcome into yet another episode of Killing, Missing, Hidden. I am still pleasantly surprised every week when I come on here to find out that our hosting platform hasn't pulled the plug on us. And when I see that people are still tuning in, that's pretty cool too. I'm your host and buddy Brad, former defense attorney extraordinaire. I hope everyone is doing well today, avoiding the virus and all the hard work that you can. Today's tale hits a bit close to home. See, I work and live in the Montgomery area, which is only about 13 miles from the scene of our story for today. Since somehow KMH has become the most popular true crime podcast in Alabama, I'm truly hoping this episode will do something to help solve this crime. I guess I'm saying it would mean a lot to me if y'all would pay extra attention and see if you can help the police in any way, even anonymously. And if you need financial incentive, it's there. There's about $20,000 in reward money to be collected if you help solve this case, half of which was contributed by actress Polly Perrette of NCIS fame. She lived here for part of her childhood and wanted to help out. Oh, and before I forget, we need to do a shout out to listener Monica. She suggested this one. So let's just jump right into the opening act. Now, Prattville, Alabama, where our story is set, isn't exactly a huge town. This was especially true in 2001. It had a population just shy of 25,000 and had that classic southern small town feel. To this day, it still works hard to maintain an old-timely Main Street area downtown that seems to be pulled straight from the Andy Griffith Show. It's one of those towns where neighborhoods during the summertime are just packed full of kids on bikes and that sort of thing. There's a football game going on in every other yard. You see kids bouncing from door to door. And crime, real crime just isn't something that happens in Prattville. Now we go to Candlestick Mobile Home Park, just off of Highway 31, and it was no different than any other neighborhood. And it was here that Shannon Polk lived. She spent her summer days playing with her friends, of course. But like I said in the intro, Shannon was this rare soul who just loved everyone. She would spend her mornings sometimes just talking to her elderly neighbor, Miss Mary, out on her front porch. Whenever someone had a new baby, Shannon would pop in every few days just to check in on the kid and see if she could help in any way. And she did all this on her own accord. Her mom worked hard and was a single parent, and oftentimes had to leave Shannon and her sister home alone. So she was really this unique person. She fell into that category of never met a stranger, and it genuinely applied to her. But sadly, that may have been the very reason why she never came home on the evening of August 16th, 2001. Now, she was a very good girl, very obedient. She knew that she had to be home for dinner by sundown. Marie, who was Shannon's mother, knew instantly in her gut that something was wrong when Shannon wasn't in the house by dark, but she managed to keep her worries in check until about 9 p.m. when she just couldn't take it anymore. That's when she had to call the Prattville Police Department in an almost total panic. And to their credit, the police went to work immediately looking for Shannon. Over the next few days, intense searches were conducted with dogs and boats, and even helicopters. Police quietly feared the worst after neighbors reported Shannon speaking with a man who none of them knew from the neighborhood. Law enforcement were prepared to conclude that young Shannon had been kidnapped due to her trusting heart. The search kind of got a chill to it after about a week. and then it extended into 2 weeks, and then a month, all without finding any evidence to provide a lead. Though arrest was made of a Ty Foster who lived in the same neighborhood, police found no connection between Foster and Shannon's disappearance. Foster's a scumbag. Let's just be blunt. He was arrested for sexually assaulting a 9-year-old boy. It wasn't until October 6, nearly 2 months later, that police would finally be able to find a clue. And it was the worst clue of all. Shannon's body, now badly decomposed from the Alabama summer sun, was found by hunters about 15 miles north of Prattville. She was inside of a garbage bag after being bound with a rope. Now this, like I said, this had a chilling effect on the residents of Prattville. Some called it an eye-opening experience or even kind of a coming-of-age moment for the town. Parents tightened their reins on their children, limiting how far they could go, forbidding them from speaking to anyone they didn't know, and requiring their kids to be in the house while daylight was still over the neighborhood. All the evils the news told them about from across the world, yeah, they had finally invaded their little community. And police weren't immune from this change either. However, instead of hunkering down, it did light a fire under them. The Prattville PD, along with the Autauga Sheriff's Office, flooded with the streets with officers, and they said they interviewed literally hundreds of witnesses, just anyone that may offer a glimmer of hope or insight that could provide that one little bit of information they needed to develop a lead, to provide some direction to their investigation. But disappointingly, no one they spoke with could offer any useful information. They eventually formed a special task force called the Shannon Task Force, which still meets today. And it's made up of members of the Prattville Police Department, the Autauga County Sheriff's Office, the Alabama Bureau of Investigation, and even representatives of the FBI. Meanwhile, of course, Marie and Shannon's other family did what they could to help. Vigils were being held constantly in Shannon's memory. Local news stations were pestered to run more stories about Shannon, but the timing was really, really bad in this case. And it's sad to say it in that way, but it's true and it's understandable because Shannon being found in August of 2001 means she was discovered right before the September 11th terrorist attacks on the United States. Now, that didn't chill their efforts. They fought as hard as they could, but the news was much more interested in talking about Middle Eastern affairs than a little girl going missing in Prattville, which is sad, again, understandable. They did get special permission from the city to plant a tree, which still stands today, 20 years later, and bears a plaque in honor of Shannon. So we've gone through the chill, now we enter cold case territory. You know, heartbreakingly, the case just turned cold after a couple years. Police continue to chase down tips, and like I said, that task force still meets, but they went through a real, real dry spell on leads. Now, the task force thought they had made a really big break when they learned that two other girls, Teresa Dean of Macon, Georgia, and Heaven Ross of Northport, Alabama, were abducted under suspiciously similar circumstances as Shannon in 1999 and 2003, respectively. So they worked with the Georgia law enforcement and the Northport law enforcement and to see what connections they had, what links. Was this a common kidnapper? But the three agencies ultimately determined that the cases were not linked. Again, thanks to Shannon's family and even some of the local media here, Shannon's case was featured on America's Most Wanted not once but multiple times during the years. And it was on one of these episodes that the actress Pauly Perrette made a special appearance just to advocate on helping to find Shannon. So, there was a lot of people working hard to help find this girl. Now, in 2007, which would be 6 years later, the task force received information that finally gave them some direction. They found some witnesses who were able to create a composite sketch of the stranger Shannon was seen speaking to the day she disappeared. This sketch showed a white man in his 30s with closely cropped hair, either a goatee or a full beard. More of a pencil type beard, with a very distinctive mole under his right eye. So police took this and they distributed the heck out of this sketch. They sent it to every newspaper, every news show, every other source of information people would look to about this. It was shown multiple times on America's Most Wanted and other TV programs. And that's what they relied on until 2017, when a devastating discovery was made. Unreleased evidence determined that the sketch was not correct. The man police had been looking for didn't exist. He wasn't a true suspect. District Attorney Randall Houston stated, quote, "New information has come out proving that the composite is not credible." For 10 years, people had been chasing a ghost. It was later disclosed that the sketch was based primarily on the report of two neighborhood children, one of which at least later admitted as an adult to concocting the sketch in her childish way, thinking it would help police to stay motivated. And we all know how important time is in investigation like this. And police had just spent 10 years chasing a red herring. And there's also the unknown impact the sketch had on the public, right? How many tips were not provided because someone said, well, I think that fellow was involved, but he ain't got that mole, so it can't be him. You know, if your neighbor Billy Bob had made some suspicious comments about Shannon's case, but, you know, he was a fat African-American man who was bald, you're probably not going to call the tip line. He looks nothing like that drawing. And we trust those drawings. And then to find out 10 years later that the drawing was wrong, what are the odds that Billy Bob's still your neighbor? Or that the average person can remember even the details of what Billy Bob was talking about? This is a point where I really should be using a thesaurus, but I can't think of a better word. This is just devastating to the investigation. I don't know how much... it's impossible to know how much damage this did. But nevertheless, you've got to give this family credit. They kept hopeful. And more progress was made. Enough evidence was eventually gathered that the district attorney impaneled a grand jury of 18 citizens to review all of the evidence, all of the suspects, all the notes, everything police had conducted to see if it was possible that some person of interest could be charged with Shannon's disappearance and murder. Law enforcement and prosecutors were very optimistic, claiming this was their best chance to solve the case in 16 years. And while the grand jury met multiple times and even had their session extended, I think they were originally impaneled for 6 months and it was extended at least another 6 months. And they did do some good. They were able to eliminate some potential suspects police had been looking at. They couldn't identify Shannon's potential killer. At least they narrowed down the scope of the investigation, but sadly, they didn't get to where they needed to go. Okay, now I'm going to put on my lawyer hat or tie, like we said a few weeks ago. Here's what a grand jury proceeding really is like, at least in Alabama. So, the grand jury is only for jurors and prosecutors. So, I can't really speak to personal experience about what goes on in there, but I certainly know I have an idea from my conversations with DAs and witnesses and whatnot. What basically happens is prosecutors bring in a witness. They question the witness in front of the grand jury. The grand jury's actually, they're allowed to ask questions if they wish of the witnesses. And when the witness leaves the room, the prosecutor and the jurors kind of powwow about the testimony. They also do this with the physical evidence. And they work together in a prosecutorial way to help try to find out whether or not someone should be charged with a crime. If you've ever heard that expression that any prosecutor worth his salt could indict a ham sandwich, this should help to help you understand why. There's nobody there to defend whoever their target is. If prosecutors have decided that we're going after the husband in this murder case, or we're going after the mother in this murder case, or what have you, they can build that case real easily. They get to choose what evidence is presented to the grand jury. They get to choose what witnesses come in. They get to ask any questions. There's no rules of evidence or anything like that. The whole idea of hearsay and stuff like that doesn't exist. This is a private room where the evidence is reviewed, and it really depends a lot on the integrity of the prosecutors, how effective this process is. And, you know, they're allowed, like I said, if you've got not so clean prosecutors, they're allowed to do the traditional crap of, well, how long have you been beating your wife type questions, or pull out whatever tricks they want. So how do they get away with this? Well, it's because everything that goes on in the grand jury room is highly confidential, and at least in Alabama. You can't obtain witness statements. You can't know what the jurors were asking about. It's just a sealed room. Now, having said all of that, prosecutors love grand juries because it's a way for them to dump cases they don't like. Police will bring them cases. Sometimes police will be hot and heavy about a case, and they can use the grand jury to say, well, they just didn't indict. They just didn't believe the evidence. But by and large, it is a very useful tool when you've got good prosecutors. And I will say, without hesitation, there were good prosecutors in this case. They didn't try to railroad anybody. This would have been a perfect opportunity for them to say, we got somebody and we're going after them, get an indictment, and then clear the case. But they didn't do that. They listened to the grand jury, they worked together, and because of that, they probably made a lot of progress in the case, but sadly, they didn't make any progress towards finding out who the suspect is directly. In August of last year, Shannon's aunt organized another vigil in Shannon's memory in an effort to remind residents that this case is still unsolved. Sadly, this is the last little bit we have on Shannon's case. The 20th anniversary of her death will be coming up soon, and hopefully that will reignite some of these efforts. But that is where we stand today. Okay, now it's time for Brad's thoughts. Now, I don't have a ton, but I do have some questions I want answered. And I even have a possible suspect that I never saw discussed in any of the major media outlets. Now, generally, I don't like posting links to pages that appear to be just random internet commenters, you know, stating what happened or what they think. But I'm going to break that rule today because I found a really interesting Facebook posting that I believe is from a former resident of the Candlestick Mobile Home Park, who put this together, this timeline together, that's just exceptionally detailed. It provides, a full breakdown of Shannon's movements the day she was kidnapped, based on statements this resident on his or her own collected from neighbors. Now, I'm not going to read the whole thing because it is lengthy. It's in the show notes if you want to check it out, but here's kind of like the highlights that I think folks would find most compelling, in at least for the purposes of this podcast. So here we go. So Marie, Shannon's mom, remember, leaves for work at 5:30 in the morning. Shannon is left in the care of her 16-year-old sister. Shannon apparently wakes up and starts visiting neighbors around 7:30 that morning. One of her first stops is to go by a neighbor to pick up a walker, a baby walker belonging to her nephew that a neighbor had been borrowing. And then Shannon spends most of the morning bouncing from house to house, looking for someone to play with or something to do. Almost every neighbor reported that Shannon had the walker with her as she made her visits, or when they saw her walking down the street. Don't know, you know how kids are. Shannon apparently goes home around 10 to see if her sister's awake, get something to eat, and after finding really nothing better to do. And she's not seen again on the streets until around 11:45. That's when she goes and visits a neighbor she's close with, but the neighbor can't talk because she's preparing for a doctor's appointment. Again, Shannon's playing with that walker as she scoots around. I'm left with the impression from reading this entry that she was visiting Miss Mary, her elderly friend, at this point. At about noon, Shannon goes to another neighbor's house who just adopted a puppy. The two sons were there, along with the stepfather, who happened to be a member of the Prattville PD. Now, the family rule in that house was no kids when there's no adults. So Shannon wasn't allowed to stay, and the stepfather was getting ready to go to work, so she got to play with the puppy for a little bit before she had to bounce on. And these are the last people known to have seen Shannon before she's kidnapped. At 1:15 p.m., so an hour and 15 minutes later, that last neighbor that Shannon visits leave for work, and he notices that the baby walker Shannon had been dragging around all day is just kind of laying haphazardly on one of the curbs. Marie, her mom, arrives home around 2:30. She, of course, assumes Shannon's out playing with friends or doing whatever 11-year-olds do during the summertime. Don't y'all miss summer break? It's about 6:30 or 7 when the sun's getting low in the sky that Marie starts cooking dinner and starts thinking about Shannon. At 7, she can't stand it anymore. Marie and her oldest daughter, the 16-year-old, start visiting neighbors just to see if Shannon's hanging out at their house. This kind of sparks curiosity from those neighbors, so they join in the search. And by about 7:30, there's a posse that's going through the streets. At this point, sometime between 7:30 and 8, Marie calls Billy, who is Shannon's dad, to let him know that Shannon's missing. Now, Billy lives down in Eufaula, Alabama, which is about 100 miles southeast of Prattville. So he's not close by. So it's clear she didn't walk down to his house. Other family members are contacted. You know how that goes. And finally, at 9 o'clock, like I said, Marie can't take anymore. She calls the police, and officers arrive on the scene in less than 15 minutes. Now, assuming this timetable is accurate, which is a big assumption here because this is an internet post, but assuming it's accurate and it's very detailed, so I put some faith in it, it looks like the kidnapping time frame was between noon and 1:15 p.m. on that day, that 75-minute window. Now, one could argue that really the time frame should be noon to when Marie started to search for her. But that baby walker being tossed to the side of the road and witnessed by a police officer on his way to work at 11:15 personally is very meaningful. That was the first thing she did that day, remember, is go get that baby walker. And then she hung on to it all day for whatever reason. So for it just to be tossed to the side, that you think she would have taken it home if she was done with it? That bothers me. This post also notes that 3 days after Shannon went missing, a resident of the neighborhood by the name of Jack Gibson, who was known to the kids as the Root Beer Man, was arrested for possessing over 1,200 images of child pornography. He was investigated in Shannon's death, but cleared. I find it interesting that Gibson is not mentioned by the police or media as a suspect in any of this. But for what it's worth, none of these images that were recovered were of Shannon. But Shannon was known to visit him regularly because, A, whenever a kid came by, he gave him root beer, hence the nickname. And B, Shannon was known to stop by his house and help him with his cleaning chores to earn a little bit of money. In my research, I found comments to several articles where people were complaining, saying, hey, I lived in this neighborhood when this happened, and no police officer ever spoke to me. And I didn't just find one or two comments like this. I found enough that I felt it to be concerning. I find this timeline really interesting. Like I said, I don't have a reason to doubt its credibility from the other sources I found. It really reads like somebody who's done their homework, and it's surprisingly precise. But having said all that, what good does it do for us without other information? I would say not much. It's interesting, but not helpful without some other puzzle pieces. And personally, I'm disappointed by the claims that are posted, again, as internet comments, which are worth nothing. I get that. But there was enough of them saying, why didn't the police come talk to me? That bothers me. You know, this little girl spent her days bebopping around this neighborhood. Police should have too, if they didn't. But by the same token, no one who complained said, well, I had information about this case. It could have just been that they felt neglected and wanted to lash out and make themselves part of the story, get those all so important internet points so they can redeem them when they die for their prize at the celestial Chuck E. Cheese or whatever it is you do with internet points. I'm also really shocked that this root beer man guy didn't get more attention, right? I mean, 1,200 images of child pornography, and he's not just mobbed by the media. And we know that Shannon visited his house. She cleaned for him. She was there. And we know he has this fascination with children such that he earns a nickname as the Root Beer Man. Yet, since he was arrested so quickly after Shannon went missing, I have no doubt police would have recovered some evidence about Shannon had he been involved with it. I mean, I have no doubt the cops and prosecutors would have loved to stick this case on this guy. I mean, bringing him up for 1,200 images of child pornography and a murder of a child, that they would have loved it. They would have loved it. So I believe them in saying that there was no evidence. And I feel compelled, rightly or wrongly, I feel compelled just to comment here. My goodness, does this neighborhood not seem dangerous for little kids? You have two men arrested for sexual crimes within such a short time frame after Shannon went missing? I mean, that's kind of frightening as a parent to know that this was going on in your neighborhood where your kids were just roaming the streets. I mean, I love the idea of having a neighborhood where kids can go out and play and know that they're safe. But then you have these little pockets of shadow, and man, it's just upsetting. All right, well, I promised y'all a surprise suspect, so I'm going to turn on a dime here. We're going to go in another direction, and we're going to discuss this suspect that's been ignored. A suspect who confessed to killing Shannon back in 2008, and the confession was made on tape, which is in police custody. It is true. Okay, who is the suspect? Back in June of 2008, there was a fella in jail awaiting trial on charges of raping a young girl. His name was Morris Michael Glasscock. While using the jail's phone, which of course was being recorded, it's always being recorded. If you go to jail and you talk to anybody but your lawyer, you're being recorded. Just assume that. But while he was on this phone, Glasscock said he was tired of just waiting around in jail and he'd be willing to confess to Shannon's murder. This is not a crime he's charged with, so why would he accept responsibility for her death? And Glasscock is not from the Prattville area, or at least I couldn't confirm that he was. He was facing these rape charges not in Prattville, but in Dale County, which is down near the Alabama-Florida border, far away from Prattville. I cannot find any information suggesting law enforcement looked into this claim other than Dale County gave the Shannon Task Force a copy of Glasscock's DNA. And that's all we know about this case. There's no other articles about Glasscock that I could find. I understand law enforcement wants to keep as much information as close to their vest as possible. But when you've got a published newspaper report saying this man has confessed to killing an 11-year-old girl, I think this is just me, Brad speaking for Brad, but my rule as a police chief, should I ever be one, would be police owe a duty to the public to at least acknowledge the dude has been investigated and what the final decision of the investigation was. They don't have to tell us any details, but they could say something along the lines of, we looked through Mr. Glasscock's statement, and after conducting a thorough investigation, we confirmed that he could not have been the perpetrator of this crime. Instead, we get radio silence. I don't understand that. Now, this report also gives us another tiny bit of information that we can use. Dale County gave Prattville DNA samples. This strongly suggests that Shannon had DNA samples on her body, right? And if Glasscock's DNA didn't match the unknown sample, that's a fantastic reason not to believe his story, right? And you can say that. And you can let him drift into history as a child rapist of someone else. This also means that whoever committed the crime hasn't been in jail, at least for a while. Some jurisdictions have been routinely collecting DNA evidence since the start of the millennium. I think, if I'm remembering correctly, and I tried to look it up, Alabama started doing this routinely around 2010. So while this DNA test couldn't be run extensively in 2001, it certainly could be now. So whoever did this is either not a serial rapist slash killer, or it's somebody who's very good at not getting caught. And I would find the first scenario to be unlikely based on my experience representing sex offenders who actively target children. As one of my mentors said once, if you live around chickens and you decide to kill and eat a chicken one day and you like it, them other chickens ain't safe. Now, I say all of this, of course, on the assumption that the DNA evidence is of seminal fluids or something like that. It very well could be that the DNA evidence they recovered was an unknown blood sample or some hairs, skin cells, something like that. But we just have this pattern surrounding this case of sex offenders and children. And so, in my heart of hearts, I believe that somebody did something bad to this little girl before they killed her. And it's very sad. Now, that's all the information I was able to dig up on this case. Nothing would make me happier than to see this case solved. From what I understand, this is the case in Prattville. After 20 years, it is the case. And they want it solved so badly. And it would cause so much peace to this community if this monster who did this crime was arrested and put in jail. But this is all we have, so it seems like a good place to stop the episode. Let's see what we've got for a palate cleanser. All right. How do you find Will Smith in the snow? How would you find famous actor Will Smith in the snow? Just look for the fresh prints. Next week, we'll have a joke about Blossom, so we stay on the cutting edge of popular entertainment with our palate cleanser. But still, that one was kind of cute. Okay, well, thank you for tuning in this week. Keep on keeping on. Keep on being the best killing missing hand. I can't even promo my own show correctly. Are you listening to this garbage? All right, keep on being the best killing missing hidden fan you can be. And, you know, if you're so inclined, we've got merch now. It's not a ton. It's not professionally designed, but I think it looks pretty good. You got to go to Killin' Missin' Hidden, all one word. And we don't use G's because we're country. So killinmissinhidden.threadless.com. And I'm telling you, wearing one of our shirts is like being hugged by an angel. It's amazing. It will raise your consciousness. Regardless, you don't have to spend money on the show. I do it for fun. I hope you listen for fun. I've just had people request merch. So we've got shirts, we've got coffee mugs, we've got face masks, we've got a whole mess of stuff. Check it out if you're interested. Regardless, everyone, please, let's be nice to each other. Let's keep trying to make this world a little bit brighter. Let's put an end to some of this nonsense that we have to talk about every day, okay? We need it. We need happiness. We need enjoyment and enlightenment and all that New Age guru crap. Or the stuff that they teach in the Bible, you know? Love your neighbor. Yeah. Okay. Well, stay hip, kids. With that, we're going to say, pausing for dramatic effect, Brad out.
Thank you for listening to Killin' Missin' Hidden. Make sure to rate, subscribe, and share. Questions? Email us at info@kmhpodcast.com.